to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. This week marks another anniversary of the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Much has been written on the events of that day, as well as on what led up to it, but less attention has been paid to its memory, to how Americans remember that date and what it means to them. That's the subject of our interview this week with Emily Rosenberg, the author of A Date Which Will Live, Pearl Harbor in American Memory. Philip Gerard will join us to provide a historical parallel between the Pentagon's recent order preventing more than 45,000 regular soldiers, reservists, and National Guard troops from leaving service after their terms of enlistment or deployment expired, and a similar decision made at the start of World War II. And after that, Talking History's Fiona Beattie will conclude the program with not one, but two more of her recommended sites of the week. But first, let's look at a few items of historical interest in the news. Americans just love their rankings, their ratings of the best and worst. Well, we have another one for our consideration, a list of the 10 most important innovators the United States has produced, at least by the estimation of Harold Evans, author of They Made America, From Steam Engine to the Search Engine, Two Centuries of Innovators. Number 10, Sarah Breedlove Walker. Born in 1867 to freed slaves, Sarah reinvented herself as Madam C.J. Walker, became a hair and beauty specialist, and built her business into the largest black-owned business in America, and, in the process, became the nation's first black female millionaire. Number 9, Gary Kildall, who was the true founder of the personal computer revolution and the father of operating systems for the PC software industry. Number 8, Herbert Boyer, the microbiologist who invented synthetic insulin and a growth hormone who, with only $500 each, co-founded with Robert Swanson Genentech, now worth $51.5 billion. Number 7, Edwin Drake, who on August 30, 1859, built the first successful oil well in Titusville, Pennsylvania. Number 6, Amadeo Peter Giannini, the son of immigrant fruit and vegetable peddlers who in 1904 founded what is known today as the Bank of America. Number 5, Leo Hendrik Bakeland, who in 1907 created Bakelite, the first man-made plastic and first true synthetic. Number 4, Edwin Howard Armstrong, the inventor of frequency modulation, FM, in 1935, and founder of the first FM radio station in 1939 in Alpine, New Jersey. Number 3, Henry Ford, whom we all know as the creator and manufacturer of the first mass-produced automobile that the average worker could afford, the 1908 Model T. Number 2, the team of Wilbur and Orville Wright, who solved the mystery of flight in 1903. And number 1, Thomas Edison, who is best known for his invention of the incandescent light bulb in 1897, but who went on to amass over 1,000 patents, a U.S. record. Well, there you have it. Harold Evans' Top 10 Innovators in American History appeared in the October 24th issue of Parade magazine. When we return, Jim Madison talks with Emily Rosenberg about December 7, 1941, and Fiona Beattie tells us where we can learn more about what happened at Pearl Harbor and in the Pacific War. This is Talking History. Rosenberg has written a book about the bombing of Pearl Harbor, focusing less on what happened and more on how Americans have remembered that event over the past six decades. She recently discussed her work with Talking History's Jim Madison.
At 7:55 a.m. on December 7, 1941, The first plane swooped down over the battleships. The next day, President Franklin D. Roosevelt asked Congress to declare war against Japan. December 7th, the president said, was a date which will live in infamy. What does that date mean? What do the iconic words Pearl Harbor mean? How has that meaning changed over the last six decades? Our guest today is Emily S. Rosenberg, author of A Date Which Will Live, Pearl Harbor in American Memory, published in 2003 by Duke University Press. Emily Rosenberg is the D. Watt Wallace Professor of History at McAllister College. She's talking with us today from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you, Jim.
Your book, A Date Which Will Live, is less about what happened on December 7th, 1941, than about how Americans have remembered that date. Why did you decide to write about the memory of the event?
Well, you're right. There are shelves of books, of course, on Pearl Harbor, diplomatic histories, military histories, firsthand accounts, and a lot of collected memories, too, interviews with eyewitnesses and such. And surprisingly, though, there was no book that really looked at the function that that term Pearl Harbor has had in American culture and in American collective memory since that time, since 1941. So I was eager to look at Pearl Harbor as a cultural symbol.
And over the long haul of the 60-plus years since the event, obviously, one of the key points of your book, as I read it, is that those memories have changed, that there were certain kinds of memories in the early years and different kinds of memories later on. Let's start with the early memories, the first years after the war. What did people think and remember then?
Well, the key point of the book is not only that memories change, but they're also highly multiple, really, at any one time. And even at the beginning, even during the war itself, there were a number of lessons or narratives associated with Pearl Harbor that I take up. The one that's probably most familiar to people is, of course, the story of infamy and the lack of preparedness. Pearl Harbor, since that time, is often invoked as a sort of symbol as why we need to have a strong military, a functioning intelligence capacity. We need to be awake and alert. But even during the war, side by side with that use of the Pearl Harbor term was the idea that grew up both on the left and in the Republican right, that Pearl Harbor had been a symbol of Roosevelt's deceptive tactics. You had what I take up, and which was called the backdoor to war thesis. And this is still a very widely circulating narrative that Roosevelt had gone out of his way to provoke Japan and then had not sufficiently alerted the commanders in Hawaii. And this thesis that then really stood for deceptiveness on the part of a Democratic president who sought to have a big government and an overwhelming military capacity. So this idea of Pearl Harbor often was associated with different meanings, both of which circulate side by side at the time and then in the last 60 years.
Let me ask you just a little more about this backdoor to war thesis or controversy, because as you point out, and as I know from my own students, this has legs. This continues to be remembered and thought about down to the present by people who know very, very little about American history. Why is that? Why does this sort of conspiracy thesis continue to thrive?
Well, in the historical scholarship, there have been many books on all sides of this issue of blame. But you're right, in popular memory, there's a very strong circulation of this backdoor narrative that casts a lot of suspicion on executive manipulation. There are a lot of reasons for why people are attracted to conspiracy theories, I think. But one of the most common associated with Pearl Harbor is simply that it was so unbelievable to most people that the Japanese could pull off a successful attack like this that it was a kind of logical jump for many people to think suddenly, well, we must have been sold out by someone. Furthermore, the Roosevelt administration was quick to blame the commanders in Hawaii, and they lost rank as a result of that and lost their positions. And Among the Republican critics of Roosevelt, there was a very strong strain during the war. They actually even tried to make it into an election issue. And then continuing for 60 years, that said, you know, the president should have accepted responsibility for this. The commanders should not have been the scapegoats. The president should have accepted responsibility. So I think there is also a sense that the president is the commander-in-chief, and in a disaster like this, the president should admit fault and accept some responsibility.
Yes.
Of course, this has become somewhat ironic because of the change in parties and the 9/11 events.
Right.
I think this acceptance of responsibility is now in parties in a reverse way than it was in 1941.
Right. Just one final point about this backdoor to war controversy or conspiracy thesis. As you said, there are shelves full of books on Pearl Harbor. The academic or scholarly literature, however, tends to doubt it pretty strongly. Is that correct?
Yes. In fact, I surveyed the textbook literature and found that even the textbooks by Charles Beard, who was one of the founders of the kind of backdoor argument, even his old textbooks from the 50s really didn't push the backdoor thesis very heavily. Scholars have tended to accept the explanation that amid the great welter of intelligence material that was out there, certainly the administration did not have a clear indication about when and where the attack was coming, even though there was a general sense that an attack was coming somewhere and an alert had been given. So, yes, the backdoor school doesn't have too much credibility among academic historians. However, it had quite a revival in the 1990s by some popular writers, and so, again, it circulates widely today.
Let's talk a little bit about how Pearl Harbor, this date and the memory of it, have influenced and affected U.S.-Japan relations. Can you give us an insight into that?
Well, one of the points of my book is the way in which an iconic event like Pearl Harbor can slide around in its meaning. I think that people often tend to think of history as something that stabilizes in meaning over time. But at least with a very visible cultural icon like Pearl Harbor, meanings don't stabilize. In fact, I suspect the more visible they get, the more unstable that meaning becomes, and the more it can be used for many purposes. And a very good example of that is the Japan-American relations issue. During the war, of course, the images Pearl Harbor conveyed a very racist and derogatory view of Japan. But it's very interesting, as Japan became a Cold War ally, many of these images shifted quite a bit. It was possible during the Cold War to portray the Pearl Harbor story as being an attack by very honorable and loyal and efficient Japanese people who were terribly misled by evil militarists. And in that kind of a rendering, which is sort of what we get in a movie such as Tora, 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 and in many other Cold War representations of the Pearl Harbor attack, the evilness of Japan is coded as being at that particular time, that is World War II, but the underlying efficiency and skill and expertise of Japan is highlighted in a way that makes Japan certainly an acceptable ally for the Cold War. So this sort of good Japan, bad Japan aspect to how you can tilt the Pearl Harbor story comes and goes. And when you see a deterioration in U.S.-Japan relations, as we did in the late 80s with the economic rivalry, more of these negative images come out in Pearl Harbor imagery as well. And then at times when things are going well, the Pearl Harbor story tilts to a much more benign view. It's very interesting the way in which history can be marshaled to serve both of those purposes over time, and they both coexist in culture at the same time, really.
Yes. And let's move to the 1990s, because you write very interestingly then that in the 90s, Pearl Harbor became really one of the most recognized icons in American history. How did this happen? How did it become so much more important in this decade?
You know, there's some survey data that shows that in the late 80s, people who were in their teens and 20s could hardly identify Pearl Harbor. Probably not surprising to many of us historians who realize how fleeting historical memory is. But during the 90s, there appeared to be a very large resurgence of memory about Pearl Harbor. And again, it took a status as a very prominent icon in our cultural life. One reason for that certainly was that the World War II 50th anniversary started up in 1991. And so every year or so, there's a lot of ceremony about World War II. And World War II becomes very much more prominent in our collective memories as a people. Some people have called this a fascination with a memory boom that happens in the 90s as people become more interested in nostalgia and history generally. And it was also centered around the phenomena, I think, of Tom Brokaw's book, Greatest Generation. So we have during the 90s a kind of greatest generation phenomenon in which everybody is rediscovering this generation of World War II, and with it, Pearl Harbor. During the 90s, there's also a conservative resurgence, and these backdoor narratives again resurface. In fact, they resurface in Congress, and after 1994, the Republicans in Congress actually begin demanding new hearings on Pearl Harbor, determined once again to get the blame placed on Roosevelt, which the hearings after the war, which were dominated by Democrats, had not done. Then, of course, to top off this comes the Bruckheimer movie in 2001, and that movie just saturated American culture during the summer of 2001, as probably most of your listeners can remember. It wasn't a very well-reviewed movie, but it became quite a cultural phenomenon. So by the end of that decade, there was a visibility to Pearl Harbor that was really quite remarkable.
And the media play a large role in this.
Yes, the media play a very large role. The spectacularization of Pearl Harbor in one of these Hollywood movies, Bruckheimer's movies, was very important. And I think this larger hype and visibility that Pearl Harbor had by 2001 certainly was one reason that when the September 11th attacks happened, they were by so many people experienced through the lens of Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
Pearl Harbor probably would have been recalled in any event because of some structural similarities, but that summer just before 9/11 had been so saturated with Pearl Harbor imagery that it was immediately called up in a much more thorough way, I think.
Yes. Our listeners will have to read your book in order to see the very interesting discussion you have of Pearl Harbor in the context of 9/11. Let me close with a final question here and ask you as a historian to predict the future. Will Americans continue to remember Pearl Harbor after the greatest generation is fully gone?
Well, I think so, but I also think that cultures have a way of updating their stories with new events. So that I argue in my book at one point that the story of the Alamo and Custer's last stand, that is, a group of people under siege, gets somewhat updated in the story of Pearl Harbor. And I think that the story of Pearl Harbor will in some ways get updated by the story of 9/11. I think there's a lot of interaction between present and past, and the stories we tell ourselves recirculate through new events. That may be a little bit of an unusual way of looking at history, but it's a case I make in my book.
And it's a very
people can look at that for further information.
It's a very, very interesting case. The book is A Date Which Will Live, Pearl Harbor in American Memory, and the author is Emily S. Rosenberg. Thank you very much, Emily.
Thank you, Jim.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
You're a step, Mr. Jap, to make a Yankee cranky. You're a step, Mr. Jap, Uncle Sam is gonna spanky. Wait and see me war is done. The A, B, C, and D will sink your rising sun. You're a sap, Mr. Jap. You don't know Uncle Sammy when he fights.
fight for his rights. You'll take it on the land before he'll wipe the axis right off the map. You're a sap, 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 Mr. Jeff. You're a sap, Mr. Jeff. To make a Yankee cranky, you're a sap, Mr. Jeff.
Saying he's gonna spank it.
Wait and see before we're done. The A, B, C, and D will sink to rising sun. You're a sap, Mr. Jeff. Oh, what a load to carry. Don't you know, don't you know, you're committing Harry Carey for we'll wipe.
Memories of December 7, 1941, and of the events of the war that followed have been kept alive in many museums and by many monuments and memorials around the world. Fiona Beatty tells you about two, one of which at least may not be familiar to you.
December 7, 1941, lives in infamy, etched in the American historical landscape, and there are several sites on the island of Oahu, Hawaii, that serve as tributes to the carnage of that day. The USS Arizona Memorial Visitor Center spans the mid-portion of the sunken ship, the final resting place for many of its crewmen. Adjacent to the Arizona, the USS Bowfin Submarine Museum and Park allow visitors to find out what life was like on a World War II submarine. And just a trolley ride away, visitors can tour the USS Missouri, site of the Japanese surrender on September 2, 1945. For a comprehensive guide to these sites and more, go to www.hawaii.navy.mil. And if Hawaii isn't on your itinerary, you can visit the National Museum of the Pacific War in Fredericksburg, Texas. Still growing from its original location in the historic Admiral Nimitz Hotel, the extensive site showcases the battles of the Pacific in World War II. Among them, the 3-acre Pacific Combat Zone gives visitors a dramatic view of combat locations. Visitors can step back in time and watch movie-tone news reports on the hangar deck of an aircraft carrier, or visit a South Pacific PT boat base and hear the sounds of a landing area on a Pacific island, concluding with the reality of a war, a medical unit. For more information on this and other exhibits, go to www.nimitz-museum.com.
To conclude this week's show, Philip Girard looks back at what happened when, in 1941, Congress passed the Service Extension Act, which is reminiscent of actions recently taken by the Pentagon in preventing thousands of soldiers from leaving the service after their terms of enlistment or deployment expired. Girard is the author of 7 books, most recently Secret Soldiers, How a Troop of American Artists, Designers, and Sonic Wizards Won World War II's Battles of Deception Against the Germans.
This year, the Pentagon prevented more than 45,000 regular soldiers, reservists, and National Guard troops from leaving the service after their terms of enlistment or deployment had expired. The military calls this move a stop-loss order. Others call it a backdoor draft. This desperate grab for able-bodied soldiers invokes a troubling parallel with America's pre-World War II Army. It also makes a strong case for a national draft. In the summer of 1941, the Army consisted of a small cadre of professional soldiers, augmented by nearly 1 million civilians, conscripted in 1940 in the first peacetime draft in U.S. history, for a term of just 1 year. Thus, on the eve of war, General George C. Marshall, Chief of Staff of the Army, faced a nightmare. In October, when all those draftees went home, 2/3 of his trained army would simply disappear. Faced with this reality, Congress passed by a single vote the Service Extension Act, requiring all those men to remain in the service for 6 more months. The outrage in the ranks was immediate and frightening. Life magazine reported in August 1941 that if war were declared, large segments of the U.S. Army simply would not fight. One division started chalking Ohio on artillery pieces over the hill in October. Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, publisher of the New York Times, enlisted a flamboyant reporter named Hilton Hal Rayleigh to investigate. Rayleigh embedded himself with troops in 7 Army camps, took part in large-scale field maneuvers, interviewed more than 1,000 soldiers. He found a crisis far worse than life had reported. Soldiers felt deceived by FDR, betrayed by Congress, and trapped in a dirty $21 a month job, while their civilian counterparts advanced in real careers and reaped the bounty of their patriotism. Rayleigh and Sulzberger hand-delivered the report to President Roosevelt and Marshall. In short order, Marshall reorganized the Army. Older men were discharged, National Guard units stationed close to home, key officers replaced, and the welfare of troops made a top priority. Crucially, Marshall fought to widen the draft, just in time for Pearl Harbor. Pentagon planners would be wise to dust off Rayleigh's old report about how low morale can ruin an army. Our military is growing exhausted, and so is their morale. Reservists and National Guard troops now make up 40% of U.S. fighting forces in Iraq, not the duty they signed on for. Every day, some guards and reservists die, and many more are maimed. Such service inflicts lasting physical, economic, and emotional hardship on a disproportionate few and their families. General Marshall had learned the lesson we must learn now. When the sacrifice is shared by all, so is the victory. It's time to spread the sacrifice around with a general draft of able-bodied men and women from all backgrounds, no deferments. Only then will we discover the true depth of America's commitment to the war in Iraq.
You've been listening to Philip Girard, who teaches at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington and is a writer for the History News Service. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As usual, we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that our producer is Fiona Beaton, that our studio engineer is Alex Smith, and that the opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And finally, we invite you to send us your comments on this show by email, if you wish, to talkinghistory@umkc.edu, or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.